For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 165.
On today's show, we talk about desert kites, the prehistory of Miami, and the illegal antiquities trade.
Let's dig a little deeper. But be careful what you find and don't sell it on eBay. Hello from random rest stop in Northern California. Did I say rest stop?
I think you did. Or west stop.
West stop.
West stop.
Yes. Haven't even been watching Princess Bride.
Oh, Princess Bride. I love that movie.
Hashtag pop culture reference. Yeah.
Always.
Always. So yeah, we are, you know, we record when we can as digital nomads.
Yep.
So we're stopped on Highway 44 outside Susanville at the only rest stop, the Bogart rest area.
Mm-hmm. It's one of our favorite places to stop, actually, because it's like the only space on this route across California. And also, it's really pretty here. We're surrounded by trees and mountains and stuff. So it's nice.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yep. Had to have some lunch, so we figured we'd record a segment, too. Why not?
Yeah, and while we were, you know, thinking about what we were going to have for lunch, we started constructing, you know, big fences out of the trees out here in order to drive lunch towards us.
Oh, really?
But since we didn't really know how to do it, we thought we'd look up, you know, how other people have done it.
In the past.
Yeah,
I
mean, how do they do it in the Middle East?
Well, funny you should ask. We have an article today that is called Well-Preserved 9,000-Year-Old Shrine Discovered in Jordan Desert.
I'm going to start a new podcast, by the way. It's just going to be called Segways.
Segways.
So you just like say something and you lead into something else. Yeah. And then it's just like that over and over again.
Is that really worthy? Like a whole podcast? That sounds more like a social media thing.
Listen, if you want to hear a new podcast called Segways that will release daily, email Tristan at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Said nobody ever. Anyway. Okay. So this article is, like it sounds, a 9,000-year-old shrine discovered in the Jordan Desert.
Which is super cool in and of itself.
Yeah, super old. But that part of the world, like, they just have so many super old sites. So it's not too surprising, really.
The Middle East is like the original hipsters. They're just doing everything before everybody else.
Right, totally. So this is in the Kashabiya Mountains in eastern Al-Jafar Basin in Jordan. And I'm going to be fully honest here. I legit went to Google Maps. I tried to look this place up just to see where in Jordan it is. I cannot find it. I can't get it to come up on any map ever. So just looking at the topography of Jordan and like the area they're talking about, though, this is the desert. So it's probably, well, it could be anywhere because all of Jordan is desert. But given the mountainous terrain, it's probably closer to the western side of Jordan. But I'm not sure. Either way, we're talking like rolling hill desert area, basically. So this is a Neolithic site. It's approximately 9,000 years before present, and it is extremely well preserved. So they've been excavating this like over many years, apparently, and they have found lots of different things. There's a whole like city here and everything. So there's a lot of components to this, but the most recent one is this shrine, basically.
Okay.
And the shrine has two large standing stones that are carved with anthropomorphic figures.
And that means?
And that would be the like facial expressions. In this case, it means facial expressions.
Sure. In general, in rock art, anthropomorphic just means shaped like human.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you can look at them and they're very, very rough. Like, I definitely say go check out the article, look at the pictures. Mm-hmm. They're stylistic. It's interesting because it could represent like one of the earliest examples of sort of artistic expression in the Middle East. Because most of that kind of stuff is younger than this. This is quite old for that.
Sure.
So that's one really cool thing about this site. Now, in addition, there is also an altar and a hearth that they think was probably used for sacrificial offerings or rituals of some sort.
It's like, I see a slab and I see a place where a fire happened. .. ritual.
Okay, you're right. That is a conclusion that is often jumped to. But they do have some pretty good reasons for guessing that, which we'll get to in a little bit. In addition to that stuff, the artifact-wise, they found 150 marine fossils, which is kind of a high concentration for those in this area. So they're thinking mm-hmm. that they were brought in and maybe not necessarily natural to the area. Kind of unclear as to why there are so many of those there.
Sure.
And then also lots of flint tools like you would expect to find. And then this is why we were talking about herding animals. The coolest thing that they found is a small scale architectural model of a desert kite.
Desert kite.
Desert kite. I know. It sounds like something that should be flying in the sky, right?
Yeah. Now, a desert kite is I mean, think of a kite shape, uh-huh. right? It's a V-shaped enclosure made of two stone walls that hunters would herd game into with some sort of cell or trap at the end, you know, so they could run them into it.
Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of game drive fences in the North American archaeology as well.
Yeah.
You know, both Canada and the U.S. and probably, you know, pretty much everywhere, especially in the big open plains. And there's the famous buffalo jump site, which is in Wyoming, uh-huh. I think.
Yep.
Where they literally run buffalo off a cliff and then just like, you know, eat them at the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in this case, they were actually digging out a pit of some sort for the animals to be corralled in at the end, or sometimes multiple pits too, just depending on how big it was. But yeah, I love how in that case, they just took advantage of the natural terrain and were like, cool, we can just run them off of this edge.
Yeah, for sure.
Very Lion King.
Wow.
So yeah, the pits at the end, the cells or pit traps that they called them, it would be just an easy place to slaughter the animals that they were herding, right?
Yeah. I would imagine if they had enough animals that, like if it was a herd of animals, then, you know, some of them might just die by virtue of going into the pit and being crushed by other animals too.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, it brings up another question of like what kinds of animals they were doing this to.
Sure.
They don't know if it was like herding domesticated animals that they just needed to round them up, mm-hmm. maybe for slaughtering, maybe for doing whatever else they needed to do with the animals, or maybe it was to herd wild animals mm-hmm. into it. And I imagine if it was herding wild animals, then it would only be like a handful of them, maybe not nearly as many as a domesticated herd would be. So
yeah,
but we just don't really know.
It's really got to be one of the oldest forms of hunting, because trying to throw something at an animal and actually kill it without it turning around and saying, "What the hell are you doing to me?"
Yeah.
And actually trying to kill you.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously scavenging was one of the first ways that, not really hunting, but, you know, food, you know, procurement. But just realizing the fact that, hey, if I chase these animals, they're going to all run in one direction. And if it's a herd of animals, they're more predictable mm-hmm. because they're going to run together.
Yeah.
You know,
but think about this, though. Like these things can be over a mile long in some cases.
Well, they'd have
and,
to be.
And they're stone walls that are hand placed stone walls.
Yeah.
So much effort had to go into building these things. Like, how do you get to the point where you even like think, oh, maybe we should try this and maybe it'll actually work?
I just think that they just kept making the walls longer and
longer.
What do they have to do?
Yeah.
It's not like they're, you know, binging Netflix and say, man, I don't think I'm going to build any wall today. Like their only job is, you know, having sex, raising babies and eating.
Well, yeah. But like I'm looking at the effort that it would take to build these walls. And I'm like, who was like, let's do this instead of hunting for the day, because this might eventually work to help us corral an animal.
Sure, but I think if like a wall's a mile long and maybe there's one on either side in like a kite shape,
mm-hmm.
I would imagine that mile of stone, if we're just taking that extreme length as an example, mm-hmm. was built over possibly hundreds of years.
It could have been,
you know, because different groups, different people would just like continuously add to it.
Right.
You know, anytime you're chasing game and it runs around the end,
mm-hmm.
you're like, God, like, damn it.
Yeah.
I just need more stones.
Yeah.
We need like
to make
20
this
more
longer.
Feet of wall.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, and they might have been hunting wild gazelles,
mm-hmm.
which are mostly extinct now.
What, that version of gazelle? Because there's definitely gazelles now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the ones that they were hunting are mostly extinct now. And there were a lot of them on the ancient landscape, probably. Mm-hmm. And they found bones associated with town sites and stuff like that. So they know that they were hunting them and eating them. So the question is how they were doing it. And this might have been one way, possibly. When you see the pictures, like the walls are really low. So they mm-hmm. could easily just hop right over it. I'm kind of like how good were these things, you know?
But it only has to be so good, right? You only need a couple animals to feed a family.
Yeah. And a group, so. Like the rest can just jump over and go. And
Some are going to jump, some are not. And you only need the few some are not that, you know, you can kill.
Well, there's definitely a lot of them spread across the landscape. There's an estimated 5,800 of them across Middle East and Southeast Asia. So it clearly became a methodology that, although there's regional differences, it's pretty, you know, widespread and very similar across the different areas.
It's one of those technologies that's incredibly obvious if you're a hunter.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like, I need to make it easier to shoot this thing.
Yeah.
Or spirit or whatever.
Like, I have a feeling that, you know, they would have got these ideas with even just like natural topography, you know, cliff faces, walls, other stuff like that. Forest, not forest so much in some of these areas, but, you know, just like natural things that herds of animals would steer clear of.
Yeah.
It's like, let's just put something there in its way.
Yeah, totally. You know? So do you want to know how it got the name Desert Kites?
Probably crazy British pilots would be my guess. They name everything.
You ruined the surprise. This is my favorite
That's
part
just
of the
a
story.
Guess. I didn't
oh
even
my
read
God,
it.
You're
I
the worst.
Know.
So the Royal Air Force pilots that were flying around in the area in the 1920s saw them and thought they looked like kites from the air, and that's how they got their name. They just started calling them Desert Kites. So
nice.
I thought that was kind of cool. A little bit whitewashed, but...
Yeah, I mean, wonder what they... We probably don't know what they were called 9,000 years ago, but there must be an Arabic name for them today. Maybe. You know, if it's Arabic... Do they speak Arabic in Jordan? I imagine they do, right?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. Yeah,
probably.
Well, who knows?
I did read that the first one was found probably in like the early 1900s before the pilots gave them the name, and they were just completely like flummoxed by it. They had no idea what these walls were doing in the desert. The first like recorded instance of somebody finding them. Now, whether those people talked to the local population and asked them what they thought of them and what they were called, that's a different question. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't find anything about that. But yeah, so the first name given to them was by these pilots, and yeah, they thought they looked like kites.
Wow, there you go.
Yep. But I like to point out that the shape is not always really kite shaped, and sometimes like the enclosure at the end is like really blobby, and like there'll be little like points coming off, and there'll be multiple pits where they're gonna, because like the hunters would work in groups, right? Like one of them would be herding them down the funnel, and there'd be another group of hunters like down at the pit or around the pit, like herding them into the actual like dugout deep parts of it, because they couldn't dig the whole thing out. They would have deeper sections of it that they would be pushing the animals into.
For sure. Yeah, like I said, the whole goal is to just kill a few animals.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's not overthink it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if it was domesticated animals that they were trying to do something with, I feel like it would be a different strategy. But if they're just trying to hunt and kill wild animals, then yeah, they just need a couple of them.
I mean, domesticated implies they can just walk up to them, you know, because that's what domesticated means, kind
of.
You know, like you are herding these animals. They're not afraid of you anymore. Like, you can walk up to them and do whatever you want. So that being said, we do herd domesticated,
like cows,
obviously,
and
cows.
Stuff.
Yeah. When you got 100 cattle that you're trying to wrangle into a pen, you funnel them into a thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how they do it. But unless there was some sort of pen for whatever reason they needed to bring this herds of animals, but I can't imagine even domesticated animals they had in really, really large numbers.
I can't imagine. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know either, but my thought is this is for wild animal killing.
Yeah.
Because it's a model that's been used in every single like plains, wide open environment across the planet.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, the hard thing about these sites is that there's almost no like artifact remains with them usually. Sure. So you can't know.
Wouldn't there be like bones or something in the pit, and or even like stone tools or something?
Not with these ones. Now, that's not saying that other similar ones across the world might not have artifacts in them, but with these ones in particular. And I don't think I mentioned this yet, but the site that this shrine is on with the scale model of the kite, it has large, full, real desert kites on it as well.
Yeah.
So, and they didn't find any artifacts associated with those. So it's just still a question, because, you know, you don't want to make an assumption on what people were doing or how they were using something. So the cool thing about these, and this is why there's so many regional differences, is that the shape of them would be really based on the topography. They would put the walls like on slopes so that they can't really see them until it was too late.
Yeah.
And then the pits at the end were deep, but they're often hidden behind bushes or slopes. The slope was really important in helping to like hide these things. And all of a sudden an animal would go over a rise and then fall into a pit, and because they didn't know it was there, and they were just trying to escape the raging band of hunters behind them, you know?
Raging so, band of hunters.
Yes.
Right.
That's how I imagine it went. Well, like a lot of arm sure. waving and like running and yelling was happening to like herd them into these pits.
Yeah. Well, see, that's, and then they, you know, the deep pits, of course, the animals would fall in and then not, presumably not be able to get out or be injured while falling in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you got your buddies falling in on top of you and that's not going to be great either.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. I'm surprised either they cleaned up really well or whatever, you know, they're trash, but I would be surprised if at some point there weren't like stone tools, because they'd have to shoot them
yeah.
or spear them or something, or just let them die naturally, I guess, and then mm-hmm. go eat them. But yeah.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean, maybe there are some tools, but tools themselves don't say exactly what they were doing there, except that yeah. they had the tools. So like we talked about before, the walls are not usually very high and the animals could jump over them. But again, it was just this really like ingenious way of like herding them in the right direction. So even mm-hmm. though they could have veered off and jumped over the wall, they mostly didn't, because they were using that herd mentality of the animals to keep them going in the direction
yeah.
before they finally, like through the funnel, basically, before they finally like would end up in the corral or the deep pit or wherever they were trying mm-hmm. to get them to. And then this site in particular is pretty interesting because it is part of a larger Neolithic campsite with several of these full-scale desert kites, and then this shrine that they found, and the shrine having this smaller model in it.
Yeah.
So again, I don't know the size of the model. I wish we did, because I'm like imagining like a little like architectural model that somebody could like carry around. But I think it was probably bigger than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm wondering, yeah. I mean, again, shrine, altar, come on. Maybe it was just like the strategic game plan area
maybe.
Where somebody stood on the altar or near it and was like, had, you know, had little figurines of game around there.
Yeah.
And then they're like, here's
like move this way.
Yeah. Like here's yeah. where you need to stand. And they had the scale model of the fences.
Oh my God. I totally hope that happened. Yeah. I love that idea.
I know, right?
It's like a war map, but yeah. for hunting game.
Exactly.
No, that's game amazing. Plan. And it could have been, cause I think that one of the things that they did find there too, were like little zoomorphic figurines too. Mm-hmm. I think I read in one of the articles that they had it. So maybe they did. Maybe they were just like making a game plan, like a literal game plan.
Yeah.
But you know how archaeologists are. They love to like bring ritual and sacrifice into it. So there is the theory that this altar and hearth were for sacrificing in front of the gods so that they would hopefully have good hunting luck at their yeah. kites. Maybe. It's an option.
Right. All right. Well, we are going to leave these kites and head straight over to Miami, because we're going back to the Miami Circle, something we've talked about on this show, and mm-hmm. something, it's kind of where Rachel and I met. To
yeah.
be honest,
like we have a personal experience at
yeah,
this site.
Yeah. Not the circle itself, but another site associated. Well, they found more stuff, more human remains, and probably more circles, because these people love their circles.
Yep.
The Tequesta Indians, they love circles.
Yep.
So anyway, we'll talk about that on the other side of the break.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to episode 165, and as promised, we are talking about not exactly the Miami Circle,
not
but the
quite,
area.
But
yeah, the area around the Miami Circle.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's the whole area of downtown Miami is basically a big archaeological site.
Which is no surprise. It's right off the Miami River.
Yep.
Tequesta Indians were there for thousands of years.
Yep.
You know, until they were all moved to Cuba, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But they were there for thousands of years, and yeah, I mean, flourished right there.
Yeah, definitely. So this article was really fun to read because it was kind of like taking a walk through history.
Yeah.
So the first sentence of the article, I'm just going to read it really quick. It is, Archaeologists have discovered prehistoric human remains, ceremonial artifacts, and possibly the footprint of an ancient dwelling on the site of a planned 75-story residential condo tower in Miami. And it goes on from there. But I read that and I was like, is it 17 years ago? And this is an article about the project that you and I met on? Because
17 years ago?
Well, we met in 2005.
Jesus.
I know. But I was like, oh my God, this legit could have been written about the project that we were on exactly 17 years ago. So totally crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So I'm sure we've talked about this before, but we met on a CRM project, an archaeology project in Miami, downtown, kind of met on that project downtown.
Yeah.
And it was a very similar thing to what this article is talking about.
Well, we were there on the Miami Circle a little over a year ago.
Oh, yeah. We went back and visited. Yeah, totally. So we have a lot of history with this area and this project. And when we were doing that CRM project back in 2005, 2006 timeframe, it was, again, it was for a large condo tower building that they were going to put up. And we were excavating Native American burials there. And there's this area called the Well, and we were part of the Well crew. And it was basically like a huge hole that had been, in colonial times, had been turned into a well. But down in the bottom of that well, and also in other like areas around it, there were just burials, Native American burials everywhere. So we had this mishmash of colonial era stuff with Native American burials and Native American artifacts and just like a whole like huge mess of stuff in this well area. And that's where you and I met. And that is the project we worked on.
Yeah. And here's the thing. The well area was, you know, it's called the well because, as you mentioned, it was literally like bored out as a well.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like
it had like straight walls and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
It was done like mechanically or something.
Right. But before that, it was, and they put the well there because it was a place where water would naturally kind of well up. Maybe that's where that name comes from. Anyway, now water would naturally come through there. And I'm not sure of the mechanism that caused it to, you know, come there more than someplace else because it was a limestone rock.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, underneath all the other stuff, it was just limestone down there. And the thing is, the brackish water of the Miami River to the south of there, of where we were digging, and then the intercoastal waterway to the east of there, you can't drink that, obviously. It's salt water. It starts to transition as it goes up to Miami, but it was still brackish right there. But the water that filtered through that limestone was good to drink.
It was good, yeah. The limestone acts as a filter on the water, so yeah.
And I don't know if the Native Americans who lived there had any problem with drinking water where they also put their dead, but I find it interesting that the Spanish didn't know anything about the fact that there were bodies basically buried in these limestone solution holes, which basically naturally formed holes in the limestone, all over the place right there.
Yeah.
And the water they were drinking was basically filtered through these bones and bones of other animals.
Yeah, it's like really, really morbid when you think about it like that.
Yeah.
It's, super interesting. But they couldn't have known. They had no idea that they were, you know, digging a well into a Native American gravesite. Well, I wouldn't think so. Maybe they did, because they probably would have found some bones while they were doing it. But so that was our story. That's how we met. And the whole area has just a really interesting story. The Miami Circle, it was excavated originally in 1998. So this is before we were there. And there was basically public outcry over the whole thing, the way it happened, what they found, and the way they handled it. And in the end, after all that drama, the developer was basically forced to sell the land back to the state of Florida.
Yeah.
And then Florida turned it into a park. They basically reburied it and turned it into a park.
Yeah.
And that was in part due to lack of funding. Like, they just didn't have the money to turn it into some kind of like learning center or something like that. Mm-hmm. So park was really the cheapest and best option.
Yeah, and you can't really move it.
No, you certainly can't. And we went and saw it, and I was very underwhelmed, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, you can barely even tell that it was an archaeological site of some significance in this area by what it is now. It really is just a dog park.
Yeah, they've got reader plaques all over the place. If you stop and bother to read those, you can see it. And then there's a a cement-like walkway that I think kind of roughly follows the orientation and path of the Miami Circle, which has now been reburied.
But yeah.
It would be nice to have some sort of like structure there with a clear floor or something so you could literally walk over it and see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been neat. But like you said, they didn't have the funding for it.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then our version, where we came in, was in the 2005-06 timeframe. This would be the site. I think we called it 1MD, right?
Because that was the state designation.
That was the state designation.
State site number.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And so the developer was MDM, and they, in this article, the quote is, they paid a staggering amount of money to excavate an entire village and also preserve two of the circles found there. And I'm like, staggering amount of money? Like, they were paying us 12 bucks an hour and making us stay in hotel, like shared yeah. hotel rooms. Like,
yeah.
That staggering amount of money certainly didn't filter down to the archaeologists doing the work. That's for sure.
Definitely not.
But yeah. It was such a cool project. I know I was straight out of college and I was happy to like work on such a cool project, even though they didn't pay real great. So the new project is a luxury condo building, shocker,
yeah,
in Miami. And it is set to be built across the street from where the Miami Circle Park is. So obviously there's no surprise to anybody that they found more human remains there.
Yeah. And the human remains that they're finding in large part are from, as I mentioned before, the Tequesta Indians. Mm-hmm. If it's not like the Spanish or something like that, because they spent a lot of time there as well.
Yeah, but, I suppose they must have a reason to think it's native as opposed to colonial. Yeah.
I'm
but
just saying, like, in the area, there could be Spanish remains.
There could be,
because
yeah.
they definitely lived there for
it's
a while.
It's the mouth of the Miami River. Like, everybody yeah. wants to be there. It's
sure.
easy access.
Well, and like I said, the Spanish basically kicked out the Tequesta.
Yeah.
And you know, set up shop there.
Yeah, definitely.
So, but they were there for, I mean, 10,000 years
mm-hmm.
With a lot of history right there. Mm-hmm. And this whole area known as Biscayne Bay, which is just to the south of there, was just a rich place for mm-hmm. people to live.
Yep. And the mouth of the Miami River was, you know, there's so many resources no matter which direction you went. You had the bay, you had inland towards the Everglades. Like, it was just, mm-hmm. there's so much access to so many really resource rich areas right there.
Yeah.
So the new building is in the financial center of Miami, known as Brickell. It's fast developing. It's full of high rises. Yeah. We saw it. It's like you're walking around like glass and stone structures just everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And the crazy part is that most of it is definitely like built on, you know, human remains. The whole area has a really high likelihood of containing human remains.
It's just like the movie Poltergeist. You know, like the whole thing is based on the fact that this high rise, this housing development in, I don't know, Arizona or something
uh-huh.
was like, you know, oh, it's built on an Indian burial ground is how they said it, you know. So that's why mm-hmm. there's all kinds of crazy going on there.
Yeah.
But this is literally built on a Native American burial ground.
No, it actually yeah. is. Yeah. And you would think that might stop people from buying the condos, but apparently this area is in such high demand that they can't build them fast enough and yeah. they're selling out before they even like finish building them. So
and that's all over the country, as yeah. you know, we're finding out as two people that just sold a house.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough inventory, as our realtor was telling us. Mm-hmm. So these things are going up fast and there's a lot of them going up. So
yep,
and
definitely.
Especially in an area like that, I mean, you have to build tall and narrow because there isn't a lot of space.
Yeah, definitely.
Unlike Dubai, where they just throw a bunch of sand in the water, just make land.
Right.
You know, I don't know why they're not doing that in Miami. So,
oh, I'm sure there's regulations and things that make it
right.
not feasible.
Well, and I hope for Miami's sake that the bottoms of these brand new buildings are, you know, shops and stuff, because they're probably going to be underwater in probably, you know, 20, 30 years. And you're going to be boating up to where you're at.
Yeah.
A lot of yachts in Miami, so that'll be okay. And then, you know, you'll get out onto the second or third floor where right. the water is and then go up to your house.
It's like a futuristic movie right there.
Oh, my God.
But don't you remember the one that we were excavating for is a Whole Foods now? Like the
oh,
whole
yeah.
that whole base level
yeah.
is a Whole Foods and probably yep. parking too underneath it, I would guess.
I think we parked in that parking.
Yeah, we might
yeah,
have.
Yeah, we parked on the street close to it. But yeah.
So that seems pretty standard for that area. Yep. Well, anyway, they are very well aware of the fact that there are going to be at least Native American sites here and probably human remains. They have a whole map showing the likelihood of these in the area. And this new site is square in the middle of a high likelihood place for human remains. So Related Group, who is a developer, they're quoted here as saying that they have a long history of collaborating with local officials to carefully excavate sites and preserve archaeological finds according to current laws and practices. This is not unusual for construction projects in this area and has not delayed our development plans.
Yep.
So it's really great to know that, like, we're not the bad guys this time. We're not holding up the project. They were planning on this. They were expecting this. And it's not new or different.
Yeah.
Like it probably was in 1998 when they first encountered the Miami Circle.
Yeah. Right now, as with a lot of development projects, they're just kind of monitoring as they dig along and trying to avoid things if possible. Although I think that's going to be relatively impossible, because even if they can avoid some of the more significant finds, with the building's footprint.
Yeah.
The actual building's footprint is not the actual footprint. There's going to be all the surrounding you know, gardens and all that stuff that is going to have to be dealt with. Now, the building itself, they dig down many, 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 sometimes hundreds of feet. I don't know how far the pilings are going down for these tall buildings, but in the corners and in some other places, they dig way down. And then just the foundation of the building, of course, they dig way down as well because they have to make these things stable.
Yep.
So that's going to totally destroy anything underneath it. However, the grounds around it, if anything is found when they're, you know, planning sidewalks and doing stuff like that, just like the Miami Circle, my guess is they'll excavate, they'll analyze, and they'll rebury.
Yeah. And that's what they did with the other two circles that were part of the project that we were on in the 2005s, 5-6 time frame. They just made that, they preserved it somehow. I'm not sure how they did. I don't know if you can go visit it or not. We didn't see it when we were there.
Well, no, but in the base of one of those buildings is, I wouldn't say a museum, but an homage, if you will, to what's under the building.
Right.
So there's information. I think it was closed or something. We couldn't go in. We was looking in through the windows, and you can see some pictures of the excavation
area.
And some pictures, like, I think there's some reconstructions of what it would have looked like or something. Yeah. So,
Yeah, definitely. So they can use modern methods to kind of cap it, basically, so that it's protected underneath. So the one thing I'll say, though, and this might be, like, this article is really, really well written. I think it's in the Wall Street Journal, which is not surprising because it's like a financial district and it's, you know, how this is impacting the bottom line for these guys. But the thing that I found interesting is that they said that they were monitoring right now, but then they also have these photos of, like, full on water screening set up, like fully set up. So I'm like, well, if you're just monitoring right now, like, why do you have water screens going on? I don't know.
Well, it's potential that, you know, as the, you know, I'm just giving them the benefit of the doubt here, as, you know, equipment is excavating.
Maybe they're checking.
They're just, they're checking what's coming out of there. And if something is found, they'll probably tell the backhoes or whatever to stop.
Yeah. You know what? That might be it. And we know from our personal experience that this dirt is very wet and very waterlogged, and you kind of do have to water screen in order to separate the dirt and the vegetation from actual artifacts. So,
Yeah, because they've already found some stuff, haven't they?
Yeah, they found a cranium that was buried about 6 feet underground. It did appear to be intentionally buried, so I would guess that means it was in situ.
Wait a minute. Is it ritual?
It might have been a ceremonial burial. Oh, archaeologists / journalists. They love those words.
I mean, to be fair, there was a lot of Native ceremony and ritual in Native American practices.
That's true.
That being said, you know, it's kind of a trope that we always go that direction.
I know. Yeah.
So the Tequesta Indians, as I mentioned before, are the, I guess, the earliest known tribes to be in this area, but the Seminole tribe of Native Americans are the, I guess, closest descendants to the Tequesta.
Yeah, like the ones that are still around and still have a tribal presence. The Tequesta, I don't think there is really any presence in Florida or in the United States at all anymore,
I just remember reading when we were there working that the Tequesta were actually forcibly moved to Cuba.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a joke. They were moved to Cuba and maybe some of the other islands, but that's kind of like where they were. And the Seminole aren't even, from what I understand, the original, like, the Tequesta were there. The Seminole weren't there. The Seminole moved in too.
Yeah.
So, but the Seminole tribe right now are the ones that have, I guess, tribal jurisdiction over the area.
Over the area.
So if anybody's going to be consulted about tribal remains or, you know, artifacts or anything like that, it is the Seminole tribe that's being consulted.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, they're the closest thing we have to descendants of the people, and they're ethnically similar enough that they can make a decision, hopefully, about these groups of people.
And those are the ones who are making the decisions. They've asked this to be fully excavated, of course. But they're not saying, hey, you have to, you know, not do anything there. They're just saying excavate it, data recovery, and then they'll rebury the remains in a new location.
Yeah.
So.
And the related group, who's the developer, they say they plan to honor that request. So
yeah. It's funny they plan to, because they really kind of don't have a choice.
Well, they don't. So. That's true. Yeah, definitely. So we'll see how that unfolds as it goes. I mean, hopefully there won't be any drama that comes out of it or anything. It'll just be a, you know, archaeologists do their work, get out of the way, and then the development can proceed forward.
Yeah, indeed. Yep.
Oh, and one final thing, of course, there's a lot of locals who are using this discovery as sort of a reason to protest the development and the building of this condo, because they say that the area is overbuilt, and rather than letting it be put, you know, turned into this giant condo, preserve it. Don't excavate it. Just preserve it and turn it into a park.
Yeah.
And one of the people who was part of this protestation, vocally saying these things is someone of Seminole descent who's part of the tribe and who actually still lives in the area. So, you know, that's a thought to be taken into account, is maybe that if it is this significant and this important, maybe it doesn't need to be excavated. Maybe it can just become something for some natural land for everybody to enjoy.
Yeah.
The way it originally was.
Indeed. And one good reason to have Native American oversight of this and the monitoring and all that. And when we were working on the there was a...
Oh, we did a smudging.
We did a smudging, with sagebrush and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And some of the Native American representative would stop by every once in a while. You know, just kind of check and see what's going on.
Yep, yeah.
And that one of the good reasons behind that is not that they don't trust the archaeologists, but it's just more oversight, because you never know when somebody's going to pocket an artifact and it ends up in an auction. And that is what we're going to talk about next. Back in a minute.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to episode 165 of the Archaeology Show, and this is the third and final segment, and we're going to go to a topic that, I mean, it's big here in the States, but it's really big over in Europe.
Very
I think
big,
because there's so much material.
Yeah,
but we're going to talk about a specific thing, but we're going to talk generally about the illicit antiquities trade.
Yes. Yeah, so we found this article called Ancient Artifact Pulled from Christie's Auction After Archaeologist Claims Suspect Provenance.
Yep. And what's provenance? Let's just define that real
quick. Yeah, provenance.
Provenance is basically...
You should define provenance.
I say, let's define this, and it's just like...
And crickets.
Deer in the headlights. Yeah. No, so our archaeologists can... Well, there's two words in archaeology that we need to talk about. One is provenience and one is provenance.
Yes.
And to be honest, early career archaeologists, probably ourselves included, get these wrong all the time.
Yeah.
Provenience is if you're looking at an archaeological excavation, the provenience of an artifact is layer 5 at, you know, 4 centimeters this way, 5 centimeters that way. Mm-hmm. That is the provenience of an artifact.
Like the point plotted spot on
where
the map where you exactly found it.
Yeah. Where is it? The provenience of an artifact could more generally be Greece as well, right?
Yeah.
Like it came from there,
yeah.
But we want to get more drilled down into where it is. So it's really, where did it come from? The provenance is, how did it get to where it's at now?
Yeah.
So
what's your paper trail, right?
What's your paper trail? The provenance is, I'm holding this, you know, Egyptian thing. Well, I got that off of eBay, and the person from there got it from a museum that went out of business, and they got it from somebody who traveled to Egypt in the 1800s on vacation and bought it from somebody there, and they got it from somebody who's in their family, and they got it from digging up a sarcophagus in Egypt back in the 1700s.
Right.
That's the provenance.
Yeah.
So when the provenance is suspect for an artifact or some sort of thing that's being sold at auction, I mean, you just assume it's stolen.
Yeah, it's usually some kind of looting in modern times. I don't really know how they look at things that they know were looted from like an Egyptian tomb in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't really viewed as looting back then. But there's a whole lot of stuff wrapped up in that one sentence right there. And many, many people could like just crucify me for the thing that I just said, because you know, museums are giving back artifacts left and right because they, you know, took them from whatever country they came from. And there's just a lot of drama wrapped up in in that whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the people who looks at this kind of thing is, his name is, I'm probably going to get it wrong, seems like a Greek name, but it's Christos Syrogiannis is what I'm going to say.
That sounds good. That's how I would have said it.
Yeah, for sure. Take a look at the article. We'll link it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But Christos Syrogiannis.
Yeah, he's an archaeologist who specializes in the trade of illegal antiquities. And he is part of this article because he flagged two lots that were going to go up for auction at the New York Christie's auction, I think like next week, like April 12th, actually, your birthday, I think, is the day that they were supposed to go up for auction.
Yes. Birthday donations can be made at arcpodnet.com. Uh-huh. So, no, just kidding. So, anyway, yeah, it's really cool. This is a, you know, just-in-time article for talking about this.
Very timely, yeah. So, he is an archaeologist at the University of Aarhus.
I think it's Aarhus.
Aarhus?
Yeah, okay. I think that's where Bill White was when he was in Denmark.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, Bill White is a co-host of the CRM Archaeology Podcast.
Right. So, University of Aarhus in Denmark, and he specializes in forensic archaeology, focusing on the trade of illegal antiquities. And he has compiled a photographic database over the last decade from public auctions and various other places where you can find photos of these artifacts, and also records that are obtained during cultural property seizures. So people who are caught looting and stealing and dealing or trading in things that they suspect or know are looted or stolen.
Yeah.
Now that latter part, the cultural property seizures, that is not available for public use. So dealers would have to work to get that data. They'd have to email public officials or international peoples to find it out, to ask about a specific thing that they're looking at selling or buying. And I think probably most don't. They just don't do it.
Yeah. So the two items that were flagged was a Greek vase dating to 450 BCE. And the second was a Roman helmet that dates from the, I guess, late 2nd to early 3rd century CE.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the evidence for the vase was really great. So that has been pulled from the auction. The helmet, however, is still in the auction for now. They are investigating further, though. So it could still get pulled.
I wonder if it doesn't get pulled and somebody buys it, but then they find out that, you know, this actually was stolen from a museum, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
What is the buyer? Do they have any guarantee?
Oh, that gets real sticky there. I don't know. I feel like having that sort of stigma around it would mean that probably it wouldn't sell. Like, who's going to buy that knowing it might be, it might have bad provenance and might be stolen?
Yeah. Either way, both of these things, one of the reasons they were flagged is because they were traced to convicted antiquities dealers. Like, these people were known to have had them in their possession.
Yeah, the vase, it's called the Nolan Amphora. It allegedly traces to Gianfranco Becina, who's an Italian trafficker whose inventory was recovered in 2001. That's all the article says. I don't know what happened to him. It just says his inventory was recovered. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any legal action was taken against him. But it traces to his items that were recovered somehow. So that's probably why that was thrown out.
Yeah, the helmet traces to the American dealer Robert Hecht, or Hecht, Hecht?
Probably Hecht, I would think.
H-E-C-H-T. Mm-hmm. He was suspected of dealing in looted artifacts before his death in 2012, so I guess he died and they found a bunch of stuff, and I feel like I remember that one. His name sounds familiar.
Yeah, you might, because this actually happened before he died. He was suspected of this for a long time, and in 2008, he sold a stolen Greco-Roman crater, and I'm not sure exactly what a crater is, but it's crater with a K.
Yeah.
To the Met, and they ended up having to return it to Italy in 2008 because the provenance was bad and they had to give it back. So he definitely is a suspect guy, and they do have more records from his inventory that Christos Syrogiannis was able to cross-reference with.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, the helmet, as we mentioned, is still under investigation by Christie's and may or may not be in the auction. Classical archaeological provenience is really difficult, and auction house people, buyers and dealers and everybody need to just do some better research to figure out, you know, why is this in somebody's possession and not somewhere else right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking that like the academic community has had to take on a policing role here, that this guy has dedicated a part of his research to tracking down trafficked objects. It's kind of crazy that that's not happening within both the police community, Interpol or whoever in the international community, as well as the dealers themselves. Like, why would you want to even buy something or be part of a deal for something that has suspect provenance? Yeah. Like, that's just, it's just not good. It's not good for your reputation. And I don't understand why we even need academics in the mix. But it's a good thing we do, because, you know, he flagged these items and at least one of them is not going to go to market anymore.
Well, I will tell you what, there have been more and more seizures of goods and fines levied and people threatened to go to jail for having things that they own that have shaky provenance, right? So if you're thinking you're going to buy something at a flea market, or you're going to buy something on eBay, or you're going to buy something, you know, somewhere else online or somewhere else from somebody on Craigslist or something like that, maybe check on it, because I mean, it's not like you're going to go to jail for 50 years, which is unfortunate that the laws aren't more strict. But and it's also, to be honest, kind of unlikely anybody's ever going to know unless somebody's looking for it and you post a picture of it on Instagram and now they start tracking you down. So, and I'm not trying to give you ways to get out of this. I'm just saying, check on these things, because there are valid reasons why something of historical value could actually be up for sale.
Yes, that's there not definitely a big deal. Are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does go back to that whole, like, where do you draw the line between historical looting and today's standards? So there's definitely some weird stuff going on there. I'd love to actually talk to Christos about this stuff, because I think he'd have a lot to say about what's okay and what's not okay, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, and this whole article too, it made me like think back to all those articles we've talked about over the years about Pompeii, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like every time we're talking about Pompeii, we're talking about, oh, they're excavating this because of looters. They're going over here because there's been looting. They need to get this out of the way because of looters. And I'm like, this is like a direct line to what those people are trying to get out of Pompeii, right? Like, they're going in, they're looting, they're finding some amazing artifact, and then it gets sold down the line, down the line, down the line, and then the provenance is created along that way, and then eventually it ends up at, you know, Christie's auction house or a private collection or something. And that's how this stuff is happening. So that's why it's so important to, you know, keep protecting our cultural remains.
It's tough, because it seems like one of the best ways to combat this is to not allow places like Christie's to even sell historical or prehistorical artifacts. But then again, it's like, okay, where do you draw the line? You know, where do you draw the line? Is a table that was in a 16th century castle now off limits as well?
Right.
Or is it just because it's Roman and 2,400 years old, or Native American and 5,000 years old? Like, where do you draw the line?
It's so fuzzy, you know? Right? So. And like, conceivably, somebody in Italy could have a Roman helmet that belonged to their ancestor, and that legit. And now that's hard. Like, 2,000 years of history and being able to prove that, that's really hard.
That'd be pretty sweet.
But it's possible, right? Sure. So, like, and that person should be allowed to sell that helmet if they want to.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes that's how stuff gets into the marketplace, right? Because, like, a Roman soldier from 450 BCE is like, put that helmet. He's like, I'm going to remember my time in the military. I'm going to put it up on the mantle here. But then, you know, his poor great-great-grandson sells it.
Yeah,
And now it's no longer tied to the history
it
started with.
And now it's in the market.
And for the next 2,000 years, it's being passed around.
Yep, and if they know that, if they have a direct, like, written history of that, then, you know what? There's nothing stopping it. Because that person, that family, they let that artifact go. So, I don't know. It's so hard.
It's best to just not covet that stuff and want to own it.
No, it really, yeah. Just why do you need to own it? Don't do it. I don't even know that museums should exist the way they do.
Go into Second Life and buy yourself a Roman villa and fill it with virtual artifacts.
I know, totally.
You could live there. You could live your heart's content. You just get yourself an Oculus Quest 2. You could, you could go into a VR reality and live that way. There's no reason to actually own this stuff because it just causes... It causes too many problems with the people who think they own it.
Yeah.
It causes too many problems with the people who probably should own it.
Yeah.
And it causes too many problems with the people who are just poor and living their lives in a town. And they think, well, I'm just going to go dig into Pompeii so I can feed my family.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? All of that. All of that.
It sucks that we would take away that income source for them. They're going to have to find something else to do to find that. But if we remove the desire, it removes the value.
Exactly. So, yep.
All right. Well, with that, I don't think
that
we...
That preachy note.
I know, right? We don't really have time for a bonus segment this week. We're going to try to start doing them a lot more. But man, I am tired. I just drove 400 miles.
You did. And you're a champ right now.
I know. So we recorded the first segment at a rest area, took a break. And now we're at our stopping point for the night.
Now we're in Weed, California at the Mount Shasta Brewing Company.
That's
so we're going to go relax and have a beer and maybe watch the Duke Carolina game tonight because I can't even believe they're playing each other in the NCAA championship.
Oh, sports
in the Final Four.
Like the one time she cares.
I went to Carolina.
That's true.
Go Heels.
Wow. All right. With that, we're out.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster and Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.